Hello, and welcome to a podcast from the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative 2010 Annual Meeting. You can find more podcasts like this on a variety of topics by visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts, or you can find us on iTunes by searching for EDUCAUSE. We feature a keynote session from John Palfrey, the Henry N.S. III Professor of Law and Vice Dean of Library and Information Resources at Harvard Law School. His session is entitled Born Digital.
So the premise of this book, Born Digital, that I wrote with my friend Urs Gasser, was really to take up this topic and try to bust the myths about young people and how they use technologies. I think that most parents and teachers, as we found from our interviews and focus groups, and we were acting really as social scientists, came at this in a very skeptical way. They would read the story in the USA Today and say, this can't be good. 8 hours a day, a full-time job using these technologies, this must be dangerous. They think immediately of a series of fears, internet safety fears, digital copyright fears, and so forth. And I want to address those fears, but to try to address them really in context, and that's the premise of what we were up to. The first myth that we were trying to take up with respect to this notion of young people born digital or digital natives is this idea that all young people use technology in exactly the same way. One of the dangers of this USA Today type article makes you think that all kids across any spectrum are using technologies 8 hours a day doing precisely the same stuff. And I think one of the things that we found in our studies, and I'm sure the Pew and Kaiser and other people quoted in this article found too, is there's a very broad spectrum of simplicity to sophistication in terms of how young people are using these technologies, the extent to which some of it is very received, some of it's very interactive. The group of young people that we focused on, just to be very clear, were the kids on the further on the sophisticated end of the spectrum. When we're talking about digital natives, we're talking about kids, not all kids, not a generation, but actually a population, a subset of those kids. I think many of them are in the schools where each of us teach. But the criteria that we used were threefold. One was that young people were born after about 1980. How many people here are born after 1980? All right, very small handful. That's good. It's very awkward, actually, to be talking to people about whom you've been studying. There may be more in Second Life. We'll see. The second factor is having access to the technology, so acknowledging the digital divide, the extent to which, even in rich societies, there are extents to which people don't have access to great technology. Maybe you do in the library, but not broadband at home and so forth, and some of those differences. And the third and the most important, I think, of the divides and the growing issue, the public policy issue, is really what we think of as the participation gap. Many young people may be born after the right date, may have access to technology, but don't have particularly sophisticated skills. They don't have the family environment where it's encouraged. They don't have school environments where it's encouraged. And I'm very focused on this as a problem, as the divide that we should pay attention to. Not so much are we going to get broadband everywhere, which is important, and the FCC and others are working on it, but really, are we creating an environment, a culture, to ensure that all kids have great skills when they're spending these 8 hours a day, however much time they're doing it, immersed in using these technologies. And I think in some ways that's the central problem, the central challenge that this great conference and this great organization takes up, which is how do we create that culture, that system, not so that one technology, when the flip video comes out, everybody can use it, wonderful though that is, but more, how do we create something systemic and something cultural that says that all kids, not just the richest kids in the society, are going to have the best skills to use these technologies, that we don't actually exacerbate the haves and have-nots problem of before. So just starting there, which is the kids that I'm focused on and we'll be talking about really are the ones on the relatively elite end of this spectrum. They come from all over the world, just to be clear. We did our studies not just in the United States, but in Western Europe. We did it in Shanghai and Beijing and South Korea and Asia. We did it in Bahrain and the Gulf. So I think there is an argument to be made that particularly among these elite kids that there is a growing population and a cross-cultural population of kids using technologies in the sophisticated ways. Just want to be sure that we don't, as we start out, make the mistake of saying all kids were born digital and therefore all will be well. The thing that makes this kind of conference and this kind of work exciting, of course, are the opportunities. I want to hit a few of them. But I'm actually going to spend most of the time on some of the concerns, some of the problems associated with social media and how kids use it, then come back to the good part. I should admit that I am a Pollyanna-ish, glass half full kind of person. I'm delighted at these technologies and how people are using them. I think it's going to turn out very well. But I'm also quite aware that much of the dialogue around them is relatively negative. So just to start out with some of the positive, I think one of the key things that we find in talking to young people is the extent to which they don't see a difference between their online life and their offline life. This idea, as we thought about it, really relates primarily to their digital identity, or expresses itself through their digital identity. So when we were asking in these focus groups about the way in which they craft their identity in online spaces, asked them about their Facebook accounts, their MySpace accounts, their Second Life avatars, and so forth, one of the things we found was if you asked them about crafting their online identity, they had no idea what we were talking about. If we talked to adults about, do you do something different in your LinkedIn account, your Facebook account, and the clothing that you chose, Malcolm and I each chose a certain tie for some reason. I wore this shark tie, just to be clear. When I became a lawyer, someone gave me this, and so it signals that I'm a lawyer. But we may think about the way we craft our online and offline identity slightly differently. But the kids we talked about, they don't see it any differently. Life is a big mesh. It's converged between these two environments. And I think this is a very important opening note, which is as they're doing things in these environments, they are doing all of the self-expression, the role play, all the things that teenagers and others have done for a long time. Sometimes it's better, in fact, for them to be doing it in these environments, sometimes safer and so forth, sometimes not. But I think that's one of the key opportunities, is to recognize that they don't distinguish between the online and the off. They see it all as just life. And much of the growing up, the friendship, the role play and so forth, is actually taking place in these digital environments. And we need to give them the handholds, the cues, to understand what's going on and to make it a great learning experience. Second aspect of the opportunity that I wanted to highlight is a real change, I think, over the last decade or so, which is, I think, everybody in this room who's been in the digital technology and learning environment had the experience of early on, maybe a decade ago, trying to use a particular tool at some moment in some setting, and you have to kind of bring students over to this other place and say, try this for a while, and then you kind of come back to the normal kind of offline learning experience. One of the great things, I think, that's happening is this notion of interoperability, the extent to which many of these tools are starting to work together, and I think it plays with this mesh idea that the young people are seeing with respect to life, that it's becoming less wrenching to pull kids into a different environment, an online environment or some technical digital environment in order to do these experiences. I think we see this in libraries too. The merger, the mesh between the digital front door, the website of a library, and the physical front door into which people walk to study, that is becoming much less broken down, and these things are much more interoperable. Another way to think about this, I have a 7-year-old boy as well as a 4-year-old daughter, and the 7-year-old is desperate for a Wii. If he were here right now, he would be tugging at my edge saying, Daddy, look at all these people. I bet all their kids have Wiis, and you won't give me one. He's into that thing where he says, you know, Elliot has a Wii, and Eli has a Wii, and say, Jack, do you know anybody who doesn't have a Wii? Oh, yeah, one or two, but they don't even go to my school, Dad. But if you think about the Wii and Wii Fitness, I saw somebody trumping into the hotel with their Wii Fitness earlier today, there is some extent to which this is interoperable, right? It's interoperable between the digital and the real space, and it's really going from something that is, in a way, ghettoized or put in a particular area, like the digital, that happens over there, to something much more mainstream and something much more within the everyday experience, not just of our students, but also those of us who are a little bit older. And the third of the opportunities that's a little bit different, I think, than what it was maybe a decade ago and before we saw quite this proliferation of the social media and other tools in kids' lives, is the extent to which they are extremely facile at using these tools for creativity. It's not all the kids, of course, but the kinds of capstone projects that you see when you go into a school where they encourage people to create something digitally or to use some of these tools in math and science or to create, say, a video for political purposes and so forth, the level of creativity, the comfort level with doing that is much, much higher. And I think the possibilities of doing that as part of the regular curriculum have grown. So it's a little bit less like finding who's that geeky tech kid, 1 out of 30, who can actually help everybody else create it. The possibilities for using these in a much more mainstream way are much higher. This is preaching to the choir, I know, but I think it's important to note some of the progress that's going on and also the extent to which changes externally in the technology and so forth can help us to drive the uses of these technologies in the spirit of pedagogical advancement. And I think these are three areas where there are huge opportunities to drive it further. So to hit some of the problems, which I think is going to be the main thrust here for a bit, just to prepare you for the downer part of the discussion, I want to hit 5 possible critiques of the way that young people are using these technologies relating to one another, relating to institutions and so forth. There's security, which relates to safety, of course, privacy, very tightly related to that, and to identity, intellectual property, which comes up over and over again, and then the two that really hit teachers and librarians, credibility and information overload. I think these are very standard refrains you hear when people say, oh, this is just declension. All these kids using these technologies is all to the bad. So the first one that comes up in virtually any discussion I have anyway with parents, less so with teachers, but with parents, is the fear that something bad is going to happen to their kids. The extent to which people are 8 hours a day using these technologies in different ways, the fear goes, will increase the likelihood, particularly of sexual predation, and secondarily that they will be able to access some kind of information that will be harmful to them, pornography in particular, but other forms of harmful speech. So this is, I think, a crucial barrier to understand the fear that parents have with respect to this, and also to take it seriously. So to take it seriously, I spent last year for my sins as the chair of a commission, a task force called the Internet Safety Technical Task Force. This task force was commissioned by 49 attorneys general. The one attorney general who opted out was the Texan attorney general locally. And it was a request to form a task force of companies and technology providers and child safety advocates and others to try to come up with an assessment of where we stand on online safety and to talk about the technologies that might help. So we convened Google and MySpace and Facebook and all the regular suspects you'd expect from the social media world, along with people who make the technologies to protect kids and the child safety advocates from Washington and so forth. And we looked at these issues in great detail and looked at every possible study that had been done on this topic. And there were some surprising findings to that study. So it is not the case that there isn't reason to fear sexual predation. There are cases in which a young person will go into a social media environment to meet somebody who wants to do them harm and who will then convince them to go into real space and then does something bad to them, sexual or otherwise. This does happen. We see that this happens particularly in what one might think of as the bad neighborhoods of cyberspace. You see this not so much in the mainstream areas, the Facebooks and MySpace. You see it much more in chat rooms that are devoted to edgier topics and so forth. You see this affecting at-risk kids. Kids who are at risk in real space tend also to be at risk in the online space, not all that surprising. And what we have seen, I think, is that the initial meeting place for sexual predators has changed somewhat from the public park to these public spaces online, if that makes sense. And I think this is consistent with the theory of the convergence of the online and the offline, which is the online public spaces are taking the place of the mall and the, you know, the common before that and so forth, and the schoolyard. The thing that hasn't happened, and this is where I think there's a fair amount of surprise, is there hasn't been an increase in sexual predation as a result of social media. So if you look at the data from 1990 to 2010, there's actually been a decrease, not an increase, in the likelihood that a child is going to be harmed in this particular way. This is the surprising finding, I think. And I think where this makes me come out is to say, yes, we need to figure out how to give kids the skills to protect themselves, whether or not they're in a physical space or an online space. They need the skills, when they are on their own, to discern between people they want to talk to and people they don't. That's crucial. And we need to put social workers into cyberspace. We need to figure out how police can work in cyberspace just as they do in real space in ways that are supportive and constructive and community-oriented. But I think the key point on the safety score is not simply to blame the technology and to say just because kids spend a lot of time on these technology tools and in these environments that they're less safe. And I think this is one of the key points to address with respect to safety and kids online. A second point is with respect to access to harmful content. It turns out that there is somewhat greater likelihood, but not a hugely greater likelihood in these environments that kids are going to stumble upon content that's going to be harmful to them. There is the possibility, of course, of an email coming across the transom. Most of these kids don't spend a lot of time on email, but that opens up and has something nasty in it. But by and large, the kids who were looking for harmful content before are still looking for the harmful content. They find it, again, in these online environments. So I think it's similarly one of these stories where, yes, perhaps there is risk in these environments for kids that they'll access some information you don't want them to, but the answer is not to blame the technology or to say don't go in there. It's to say, you know, how do you create the skills? How do you create the environment that's going to be constructive rather than negative? The other piece, though, I wanted to raise, which we presented to the attorneys general and others in this report, and which they weren't that prepared to hear about or that excited to hear about, was there is an area where there is an increase online, a very clear increase, and that is with respect to bullying. We found a very sharp increase in most of the studies, and it depends a lot on how you define bullying, but of kids being really mean to one another online, and the reporting of kids having some form of psychological harm based on what their peers have done to them. Now, there are a bunch of ways to explain this. One might say kids aren't meaner today. It's simply that a lot of the mean stuff is happening in these new environments, and for once, it's something that an adult can see. You can watch it happen where you couldn't see it in the playground or in the schoolroom before. The other possible explanation to the data is that it's recorded so you can see it after the fact, right? Someone is mean to someone else in the blog comments or in a social environment. You can go back in later and see it, which you couldn't see in the schoolyard again. So there are ways to explain the differences in what we see in the data, but it's incontrovertible that relative to these other risks, the likelihood of harm seems to be going up according to these data. So I put that in there just as, in a way, the surprising finding and something that I think all of us have to encounter. I am teaching a class every day this semester at the Harvard Law School. We've been meeting from January 4th to January 21st. It's an intensive term, and I was using a question tool in the background, and we were doing mock interviews of a client in a criminal case, and in the background I had a question tool like Google Moderator that we developed at the Berkman Center, and students are able to put additional questions up on the board. So in the front of the room a question was interviewing the client, and others were saying, okay, I would ask this question, I would ask this question, and so forth on the screen. And all of a sudden, one of the students, one of these 80 students at the Harvard Law School, put up something very incendiary on the screen. It was a very negative, nasty thing about one of the classmates. I didn't see it. I was at the front of the room looking at the interview. But it created what was clearly a little bullying, you know, story, basically. And I had to, you know, deal with this the next day. It wasn't the most fun part of the term. But I think it was a reminder to me that this is something that happens all the time in regular space, but also in these new environments. And even when you're talking about, you know, 23 to 30 year olds who have attained the top of their academic career and who are going to go be leaders and members of the bar and so forth, they still anonymously say nasty things about people's sexuality on a public screen in the middle of a classroom. And I think this is one of those things that that we have to focus on and address. Okay, second and related to safety and security is the notion of privacy. So it makes perfect sense that if kids are spending on average 8 hours a day in these environments, that they're going to be leaving some information behind about themselves, right? It's going to be recorded. This is another one of those myths that we wanted to take up. The myth is that kids share too much information about themselves in these environments. Another version of the myth is kids don't care about privacy these days. These are two separate myths, and it's important to pull them apart. On the first myth, it unfortunately happens to be true. Kids share too much information about themselves in these environments. There is no doubt about it, that in leading lives that are recorded every step of the way and where all social relationships are mediated, or many social relationships are mediated through these technologies, kids are leaving a huge amount of information about themselves in these environments, and they make a whole bunch of mistakes. When you present them with the mistakes, then they often will correct their ways. And the more sophisticated of kids make fewer of these mistakes. But let me just play out a few of them. I have a colleague named Dana Boyd who's written, I think, the best paper on this particular topic. But a few of the mistakes are these. One is that they speak to unintended audiences. So they think that they're speaking only to the two or three friends they can imagine and forget that lots of other people are watching or might be watching. They conceive of themselves as writing for a certain friend, but forget that it's a public space. They think of it as a traditional private space. The second thing is they forget about replicability and the extent to which their peers very often, as a practice, take what they wrote and then replace it in another context. So it might have been safe and behind privacy protections in one place, but it as an image or text or video gets copied from one place and put in another context and then kaplooey like this. They forget about searchability, the extent to which someone can search from one place and see lots of different versions of the same story or the same person. So just as they think they might be creating multiple identities, they forget that the onlooker can see all of these identities at once, potentially. It actually has very complicated implications for this idea of role play in these different environments, that you actually, as an onlooker, could figure out all of the interplay that's going on. And they forget about persistence. They forget about the fact that what they type today may well be available and will probably be available 40 years from now. I think many of them are going to have tattoos, digital tattoos, that they're going to want to rub off in a few years and are going to have a hard time doing that. And these are issues that when you talk them through with kids, I actually think they often do change their behavior and think about it slightly differently. But it's not a myth that they leave a fair amount of information in these environments. But shift gears to this other myth. the myth that kids don't care about privacy, that's completely wrong in most cases. The vast majority of kids that we've talked to absolutely care about privacy. They just think about it in this highly contextual way. And they think that they are being much better about protecting their privacy than they are. They all have stories. They all have stories about their friend who shared this information, the drinking party picture, and then, you know, something bad happened to her. They're all focused on this, but then they don't translate it as well as they might into their own behavior. And I think it's that toggle. It's actually that they're not as sophisticated as you might think. Not that they don't care about privacy or not that they can't see these ramifications. There are some kids who say, I'm just going to let it hang out there. There is that kind of subset. But my guess is that subset has always existed. There always have been kids who said, I don't care what you know about me. I'm going to live in this particular way. But the vast majority of kids do care about their privacy and are struggling to figure out how they can live in a way that is consistent with their values in this digital media world. Okay, third of the concerns is intellectual property. There are two kinds of concerns that I want to raise here. The first concern is the myth that kids steal their music and their movies and so forth. The other is the myth that they don't understand what they can do with information. So the first one turns out not also to be a myth. Kids, by and large, do steal music, as you may know. Under the sort of veil of anonymity in these conversations, most kids, vast majority of kids we talk to, say they do use LimeWire and Kazaa and these other things as a way illegally to get music, or they get it from their friends who have gotten it illegally, which is also, by the way, illegal. The very few kids who tell us that they obtain the music lawfully say they got it from iTunes. And then when you press a little bit in their interviews, they will say almost to a person, the way they got it is their parents gave them a gift card, and they are spending down the balance of the gift card in Apple iTunes, right? Now, this is great. I'm glad for the parents. Please do it as parents. I'm going to do it as a parent. But you can see that the act is very similar, right? The act, if you're not actually paying for it, and it's just a balance that's been up there, and you're just downloading the stuff and putting it on your iPod, it's exactly the same, even though lawful and different in that way, as the act of downloading something from LimeWire, right? At least in terms of the practice, it's extremely similar. There is no secret or surprise to the fact that Tower Records has liquidated its stores, right? There's no surprise that we have an environment in which Apple is the number one music retailer in the country. And I think this extends through to other forms of digital media. Kids presume that the media is free, that it's available, and that you then can do something with it. And there's good and bad in that. I think there's a lot of good in that for teachers. The challenge, of course, is how do we make them also citizens who obey the law and so forth? A totally different conversation to go down. It's clear, too, in these interviews, the kids know it's unlawful when you ask them. By and large, they know that the downloading of these things is against the law, and they do it anyway. They're sticking it to the man. That's part of the story. The other story, though, I think that's very important with respect to intellectual property and very important for the work of this group is what do kids do with material that is either copyrighted or subject to some restrictions in terms of reuse of that material. And this is an area where we found extreme confusion among the kids. So let's imagine that part of what we think is a good thing about the digital environment is the idea of remixes and mashups and so forth, the extent to which you can take material and make it into something, remake it into something very creative. We think of this as semiotic democracy or cultural democracy, where you can retake the meaning of your times. A really good example of this, does everybody know the case of the Hope poster and Obama? So, all right, yes. There's a lawsuit pending. Shepard Fairey, who is the artist who made the Hope poster, used an image of President Obama, and I'm actually the lawyer, one of the lawyers for Shepard Fairey, so I can say very little about this, other than to say it's a pending lawsuit about whether or not it was a fair use or otherwise permitted for Shepard Fairey to take that photograph, or a photograph, depending on what he worked from, and create the Hope poster that became the iconic symbol of this campaign. It's a very serious lawsuit, pending in federal court and so forth. And part of the challenge, I think, and part of the reason I'm defending Mr. Fairey in this matter is I think it's very important that we figure out what the rights are for people to take material and to remake it in ways that are culturally significant. There's nothing more culturally significant about 2008, in my view, than that poster faster. It's very important. But the confusion the kids have about whether they can take a little snippet of a song or a little bit of an image from something that was published elsewhere and put it into a digital collage is totally understandable when we haven't figured out whether Shepard Fairey is allowed to do what he did with the Hope poster in a campaign context, right? And so we have an issue of understandable confusion on the part of these kids about what they can do in terms of making and remaking these images. And frankly, I saw the confusion also among the parents and teachers I've talked to who ask a lot of questions about when is it fair use, when is it permitted to do this. And to be honest, there are multiple members of the Harvard Law School faculty on either side of this matter with Shepard Fairey. So even those who do it for a living like me disagree as to what the rules are or ought to be. It's a real concern, I think, with respect to this. I think the answer is use it or lose it. I think the answer is fight these particular battles and figure out where the lines ought to be drawn and so forth. But it's not obvious. It's not easy. And I do think it's extremely important. Okay, fourth issue that comes up, this one raised mostly by teachers and librarians, is this idea of credibility. It's most often stated in terms of that kids used to read books, now they read Wikipedia, they used to cite to reliable sources, now they cite to things on the internet. How do we address this? And obviously there is a core concern here that's legitimate. There's a core concern that says, in a world in which kids have many, many, many more sources available to them, how are they supposed to sort the credible from the not credible? It used to be somewhat simpler. You knew that the Encyclopedia Britannica entries, even if dull, were written by experts, and experts weren't always right. But there was a certain level of credibility when that Britannica thing was stamped on the back and a kid opened it. You go to a Wikipedia entry, and it's not that clear who wrote it, necessarily. It's not that clear whether it's one of the great entries in Wikipedia or one of the less great entries in Wikipedia, or if it changed recently and so forth. So I get the concern. I happen to think it's a great opportunity on the flip side of this, but let me state two findings from our research, which I think might jive with your own experience. So we asked students, presumed kind of late high school, early college students for the purpose of this question, if you were assigned a topic that you don't know that much about to write a report on, how would you go about learning about it? So the kinds of examples I used were the Spanish-American War, something people know probably happened around the end of the 19th century, but not much more. Lou Gehrig's disease was another example. So in the course of these interviews, kids would describe what their kind of research attack would be. And I think consistent with many other studies, they would say, if in fact the teacher had given us some course books or the teacher were available, we would consult the teacher. Fine, that makes sense. But after that, where would you go? Invariably, they say they would go to a computer, they would open up a browser, they would go to Google, and 100 out of 100 said Google, by the way, would type in verbatim Spanish-American War enter, no variation on the score. They would then look in the search results for the Wikipedia entry on Spanish-American War and would hit that, again, invariably in terms of what kids were saying they would do, and then they would arrive at the Wikipedia page. It was only at that point that there was some deviation in terms of what kids were saying they would do, and the deviation was actually quite broad. There was a breadth that ran from the most skeptical of kids who said, you know what, I'm not going to believe anything here because I believe that my co-students, other students in the class, were here a minute ago, introduced some false facts just to mess me up, so I'm not going to believe it at all. Right? That was the skepticism side. On the other side were the kids who said, this is great, the answer, cut and paste, right? And cut and paste and put it into their papers. Presumably they don't get a good grade, but, you know, that was a very substantially described practice. And I think this is where you see that range of sophistication. Very few kids, though, said I would go to the history tab or I would go to the discussion tab and I would look at who had written what in the entries and so forth. There was very little kind of engagement with how was this created. The other thing that kids did fairly consistently was they said they would scroll down to the bottom and they would look for the other sources that were there and they would clip from there. Very, very high likelihood that they would do that. I think that's a huge opportunity, by the way, for us to think about if that is a starting point, like a card catalog or like a syllabus or something, think about that bottom section of Wikipedia, those other sources, knowing that kids are looking from there as the place to triangulate when they do. The other variant of this story Is the extent to which we ask them, how do you get your news in the morning, right? How do you know about the world? And basically nobody said that they would buy one of these and sit there with a cup of coffee or their cereal and read it cover to cover, and then come back at the end of the day and have Walter Cronkite or Katie Couric or whoever it is tell them what happened, right? That's the iconic 30 years ago version of getting the news. Now it's much more by osmosis. It's in these 8 hours a day that they're spending in these technologies where they're getting little snippets. They're getting headlines. What we think of as grazing for information. They get just the basic facts. If you ask the slightly more sophisticated kids, they will say they will click on those grazed headlines. They will go a little bit deeper. They will go find the analysis. They will go find the blog entry about it. So we think of it as grazing in the first instance that most kids do, a deep dive, which is the second thing, going for something deeper. And then the most sophisticated kids do a third step, the feedback loop. They actually want to write about it. They want to blog about it themselves or take a version of it and put it into their Facebook newsfeed and so forth, or make it their status update, or send it as an IM to somebody else. So for the most sophisticated kids, you see this three-step process, or we have, which is grazing to deep dive to feedback loop, which I think is actually probably a pretty good learning model. For the kids who are the least sophisticated, at most, they're kind of grazing headlines, right? And again, that's where this big divide comes, I think, from the most sophisticated to the least. One other note on the Wikipedia front, be curious, how many people here, assume everybody uses Wikipedia one time or another, right? How many people here have actually edited a Wikipedia entry? Okay, this is the highest percentage of any crowd in talking about this book I've ever seen, of editors of Wikipedia. It's probably 20% for those in room. Are there people in Second Life? Can you wave or anything? See if this will work. Not so much waving. All right, well, maybe some fidgeting anyway. Maybe there's some fidgeting editors in there. But one of the things we saw from kids, every single kid said that they use Wikipedia one way or another. Hey, some waivers. All right. Thanks, guys. But out of 100, basically nobody had edited Wikipedia, that these were lurkers. And the one or two kids in our surveys who had, in fact, edited Wikipedia, I asked them, why did you edit it? And they said, or what did you edit? They said, well, I changed a period to a semicolon or a semicolon to a comma or whatever. They're the OCD kids. They would see this, you know, thing that wasn't quite right, and they'd want to fix it. A few of those kids now subsequently from our initial study have said that that's like the gateway drug. They figure out how to edit it. They've got an account, and then they start editing a little more. But I think it's important to note, as much as we love this idea that kids are actually creating this knowledge commons, mostly they're experiencing the knowledge commons, at least at the moment. I think, again, there may be places there where we can come up with opportunities. The last of the concerns is this notion of information overload. We hear this a ton from parents and teachers and others, that in the context of spending so much time immersed in these technologies in this converged way that I've been talking about, they're getting overloaded with information. They're just exhausted and so forth. And I think there's some truth to this. There's not probably medical truth to this. We've, you know, talked to, you know, pediatricians and so forth, and I think that the sense is that it's not a physical ailment of information overload. But I think the real concern is there are times when you do have to kick your kid outside to play soccer or whatever the equivalent is, right, the sort of offline thing. I think we probably all know this as parents and teachers. Sometimes classes should have laptop down and so forth. Sometimes you should not be tethered to the devices. The other thing I think that this points to is challenges and opportunities for libraries in particular, that the notion that there's so much information out there available from a mobile device or a PC is a challenge in a way that can be met by library professionals. That seems to me, a way to define the future of the library is to say, in a world of information overload, who are your guides? Who are the people who help you find the most credible information when you need it, who can be the ones who do the curation and the collection and create those learning spaces and learning commons and help you participate in them? That seems like an obvious next step for where libraries can go and should go, and that would be enormously useful in meeting some of the challenges that young people have. Okay, so to sum up and get to some questions before you're released from this, I want to emphasize a few things that I think are the places where there's enormous opportunity against the backdrop of these series of challenges and these very fast-changing practices. And I think they really do come down to creativity, to leaning into what these young people can do and letting them be the guides to some extent. They do relate to collaboration. These young people work incredibly well together in teams, as you may have found, and they use these tools extremely well. This class I've been teaching every day for the last several weeks is defined by having the law students work in teams of four or five. We meet for a few hours in the morning, and then they're sent out in the afternoon to work in their teams, and sometimes they work in virtual teams and use Etherpad or Google Docs and so forth. Sometimes they meet in physical space. Sometimes they have various configurations, but they're extremely good at using these collaboration tools and having something be more than the sum of the parts. And the last, of course, is learning, that these are opportunities at every stage for enhancing the way that we meet our pedagogical goals. And I think these are obvious points to all of you, but are not necessarily obvious, I think, to all of our colleagues. The way that I think we should meet this challenge, though, is also to think about the task that lies ahead of us, not just in very specific terms of how do we use particular tools in order to enhance particular pedagogical goals, but to think about the system of learning and the culture of learning that we're building. That's obviously what all of you are doing here through EDUCAUSE, but I think thinking at it at the systems level in this incredibly fast-changing, complex world is where we as a collective ought to be putting our attention. You have no idea, there's no way anybody knows what this picture is of, so I won't make you guess, but it's the personal library of Oliver Wendell Holmes. This was a graduate of our school and a justice of the Supreme Court and a law professor. He surrounded himself as his learning environment with books in every direction, right? This is an incredibly appealing version of what a learning environment was for Justice Holmes. And my sense is we need to figure out what the version of that learning environment looks like. How do we structure that same learning environment, not just as a library, as a school, and in a way that takes advantage of the amazing opportunities of these technologies, but in a really fast-changing time, recognizing that even a couple of years ago when we did the studies behind Born Digital, things have changed enormously, and the rate of change seems to be going only faster, not less fast. So rather than focusing on particular tools, rather focus on the overall learning environment and how we structure it and make it culturally something that's supportive. This picture is of utopia. I don't mean to suggest that we are going to a utopia of learning by virtue of technologies. That would be a mistake. But I do think we can get closer to a utopia than to a dystopia in this story. This is my glass half fullness. And I think one of the tricks to doing it is to take the cues from architects. So one of the things that I think we haven't yet done is actually to do the design work, to do the design work of what the learning environment that is this converged hybrid world of physical and virtual that we did when we were designing schools and libraries in the first place. So before you would put up a grand college building or a high school or a library, you would go and hire an architect, right? You would go and hire somebody who would design this learning space, and you would spend months and months, if not years, fretting over the size of the rooms, the way that the entryway worked, and so forth. This is the work that we haven't done for the virtual environment. We have willy-nilly put up web pages. We have willy-nilly created some wonderful technology tools and applications and so forth. But I don't think anywhere have we thought about what is the design of this? What would an architect do with this virtual environment? And then, just as tricky, going back to this initial point of convergence, how do we think of the intersection between this virtual space and the real world space, which is the converged environment in which our young people are growing up and living? How do we make that a constructive, wonderful, better learning environment than the learning environment we have today? And then it's that design work that I think is our primary collective challenge.
All right. Please join me once more in thanking John for a great presentation.
A session from the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative 2010 Annual Meeting. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.